Welcome to Verify Infield, the Millwork podcast. Your host, Jacob Edmond, CEO of Duckworks, will be interviewing experts in the industry to bring you insights and knowledge about the latest trends, techniques, and challenges in millwork. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting out, this podcast is for you. So sit back, relax, and join us as we explore the world of millwork. Here's Jacob.
Good morning, Andy. Thank you for joining us. Today we have Andrew Klein, and he is a vice president for Maker Product Design over at MagSwitch.
What is that? Yep, Maker Business is the title that we settled on.
Okay. Also a prolific YouTuber and product design inventor. So I've been following you for many years on YouTube, just in your woodworking journey and your product design journey. But have you on today to talk a little bit about your background, your journey to where you are today and your role with MagSwitch, and talk about woodworking.
Great. Thanks for that intro and for having me on. Appreciate the chance to have the chat. If you want to hear the very beginning, I can start at the start.
Yeah, we'd love to hear your background and how you became not only a woodworking enthusiast, but an inventor.
Sure. So I guess two points to mention from earlier childhood. And the first was that my grandfather had a woodworking shop in his basement, and I always thought that was cool. And I have some memories of going out into the woods, and he'd find a branch on a tree and he'd make me a slingshot in his shop. And he had all these machines, and it was just so cool to have this thing. So very early on, the idea of having a workshop and being able to make stuff was put into my head, and I think stuck with me in the background and activated when I got older, as far as being something that I wanted. And then I was also lucky enough to have a shop class in junior high. So I made a clock, and I learned to use a joiner and a bandsaw and some things when I was like an early teenager. So those two things happened very early in life, but I didn't really do anything with it at the time. I had other priorities. And I got a degree as a chemical engineer, and I went into the agricultural field. I worked for Cargill ended up working there for 18 years, and never really got into woodworking or making things as a hobby until a bit later. That really all started. The path that I'm on, I see as starting around 2006, when I decided that it would be a great idea to be a real estate investor, buy houses and rent them and stuff. I had a vision of maybe not wanting to just have a career and work for a company for my whole career, and at some point have my own business. And I thought, there's a million books and people telling you that real estate is a good thing to try. So I'm in my early to mid 20s. Why not give it a try? I picked 2006, which was horrific time. If anyone remembers what happened to the market a couple of years later, it was really stressful. I'm trying to navigate my way out of the situation that I'd gotten myself into. But what I did pick up a taste for was DIY projects. We had to put in a bathroom in the basement. Prior to that, I say we because I had a business partner. He taught me to do a lot of that DIY work. So I got a taste for that. It was fun to build things and transform spaces. But fine furniture, I became aware of, people also make really nice furniture. Fine woodworking is a thing that people do. And although I've gotten good at doing a half-decent job of tiling a floor and hiding the edges with trim, the level of precision and the tools, it's just a totally different world. I still know nothing about making a nice piece of furniture, and that's intriguing. And then the other side of that was my business partner was a woodworker. He had made the chairs for his family's dining room, and he had Grizzly equipment. And, so as I was getting interested, he'd bring over the Grizzly catalog and say, these tools are available. It's really industrial grade stuff. And look at all this cool stuff you can buy, and the price points are there. Like, it's expensive, but it's within reach to have a shop like this. And I just thought that was so cool. So at that point, I got into the real, I would describe it as like new love, this hobby that you're really in love with. All I wanted to talk about was woodworking. It consumed my mind all the time. I started watching YouTube content, and there was a lot less back then. Now we're getting into like circa 2008-09. As the real estate business is winding down, and I'm left with just this interest in woodworking, this intense interest. All I thought about, I'd go down rabbit hole on miter saws and just research all the brands everyone has heard of, and then the obscure ones that just sell to industry and don't really advertise much, and really dig deep trying to understand every single tool that was out there. I was just obsessed with it, and all I wanted to do was just drove my wife and friends crazy, because it's all I wanted to talk about. So there was, at the time, I had moved to Minneapolis, and there was one other person in the workplace who's a woodworking enthusiast, and I would just take him right to his edge of how much he wanted to talk about woodworking. It was really all I thought about, but I didn't realize in doing that, in especially in the online research of tool, and I was getting myself very well versed with everything that was out there and finding some gaps and recognizing that, oh, because my mind is burning on this 24 hours a day and I'm spending all this time, I'm actually starting to see some things that don't exist that maybe could. And at around the same time, I need to get my times right, because I need to go forward a few years before I was making YouTube videos. I'd say I stayed in the state that I just described: intense interest, lots of research, lots of conversations, trying to make furniture, starting to build my early shop and workbench and things. That didn't change a whole lot until maybe 2013 or 14. Somewhere in there, I started thinking maybe I could participate in this YouTube space. There still weren't that many people there making content, but there were more than when I first started consuming content. And I got to the point where I was able to make my first video and kick the channel off. It grew pretty slowly at first. John Hayes shouted me out. And my third video, David Picciuto put it on his weekly woodworking wrap-up. I think I'm getting the name of that show wrong. Is that what he called it? David Picciuto used to do a weekly thing where he'd recap everything that had happened in woodworking. And it was a fantastic segment. Being featured on it was a real thrill. He's got all of those old videos archived on a different channel. They're still out there. So you can see where he talks about my fossil table. And then that grew the channel a little bit. By a little, we're at a couple hundred subscribers, but that's still an exciting point to be like, oh, a few people are paying attention and I've got some nice comments. And, you know, this is, maybe this could be something that grows continually. That pushed me a lot to try more ambitious pieces of furniture, and was really the having that channel and getting some traction, enjoying that traction, was a big part of what pushed me to design the Twisted Table, which was really an attempt to take every intimidating tactic or woodworking procedure and shove it into one project. And the design has been criticized as being too busy, and I think that's valid in a lot of respects, but I did learn a lot. It was a success in that I was able to show to myself that I could build something really hard, and I left knowing a lot more about certain techniques, and I made a lot of mistakes and ultimately finished it, and it's still an end product that I'm proud of. So there's an ambitious piece of furniture I was able to build. It grew the channel, and it also got me a little bit of recognition from some local, very talented woodworkers in the Minneapolis area, and they put it in a museum show, actually, as I was moving out to Denver, this was happening, where I got in this museum show and I had to drive the table separately. And it was a lot of work to be there. A lot of fun. I'm glad I had that opportunity, but it soured me a bit on the direction of trying to make fine furniture, just because all of these other woodworkers that I was still just an aspiration to be at their level, all they were talking about is how it was so hard to make $40,000 a year in their trade, because it's hard to find customers and just all the difficulties and blah, blah, blah. And so that was a little discouraging. And it was in my head that maybe this is what I want to do for a career at some point, but I probably have to be a little bit flexible with exactly what I'm going to be doing, because I have a family to take care of. And the stress of trying to have my income based on building nice pieces of furniture for wealthy people, I don't think that's going to be a good trade-off. I'd rather keep doing what I'm doing and do it on the side if it's going to be that straight. In parallel with that, I'm getting the timeline a little bit wrong, I think. Somewhere in there, back to the tool idea, I had an idea for a blade that could cut a joint that comes together in 90 degree, locks together similar to a lock miter bit, but could be cut on a table saw, could be incorporated into a dado set for both thickness adjustment and also to keep the cost down and be a better value proposition because it had the dado functionality. And I conceptualized this whole tool, and this could be a product. It was the thing that I had come up with that best fit that missing in the market piece that I mentioned earlier. So I got a provisional patent in, and I found a fabrication shop to make me a prototype, and I made a video showing what it did. And that was the first, really the largest still to this day, viral hit of the channel. It just went nuts. And I had companies bidding on it, big companies. I won't mention who they are. Long story short, I end up licensing this to Rockler. Takes a long time, but they develop it and launch it a couple years later. And I think really changed my perception from someone who builds crazy pieces of studio furniture, twisted table, fossil table, to tool inventor guy. And so I'll pause. I've been yakking for a long time.
Well, yeah.
Get a question in, please.
So that was your first product design that came to fruition. But was there a point in time that was instrumental, or that you, like, what drove you to think, hey, I can, you know, take on product design and invention and patenting? Was it literally just woodworking, or did you have some exposure to that through engineering school or through your previous work experience to what, you know, the invention process was or product design?
We'll be back after a quick break.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
The field of engineering that I was in, and chemical engineering in the agricultural space, there are patents. So I was aware that I was aware of how patents work. My dad, also an engineer, had taught me about patents and why they exist. And we do this. You have a little mini monopoly to encourage invention. And so I was certainly aware of the basic theory behind it. And I'd seen it put to use in very different industry through my job. So I was aware it could be done. My grandfather had a patent. He was also a woodworker. His patent was on a carpet saw, so an alternative to a carpet knife. It was really product of the times when people were trying to motorize everything. If you look at videos from the 40s and 50s, they're motorizing cabinets, and you open the cabinet and the motorized spins around. Society's backed off that in large part, and you don't see carpet saws, but product of the times, saw to cut carpet. That actually did sell, and he would sell. I think he licensed the making of the saw, but he held on to exclusive right to sell the blades or something like that. He patented something, and it made money. And
so you were exposed to that concept very early, and at least aware of it in growing up. Because I think for most people listening, you know, and maybe this is true for you as well.
Yeah.
You know, but like inventor, having patents, product design seems like something that like, hey, I don't know how to do that. That's not something that, but coming from an engineering background, maybe as well, you understand. I know you're a chemical engineering, but I believe you probably went through general engineering and at least understand engineering as a whole to an extent.
So true, and certainly true on the engineering. On the carpet saw thing, I actually only found out about that as I was taking the patent and starting the process of the blade. You know, my mom, you're going to be like your grandfather. Wow. What's this all about? I think maybe I'd heard, but the story didn't really stick or resonate. So I really only became aware of, put my eyes on the patent and really understood that had happened as I was going through the process. I was either rediscovered something I'd been told, but never really stuck.
Yeah. So you came up with this idea, and for people who are listening or aren't aware, but it was a basically a dado set. dado stack setter. So if you're familiar with dado stacks on your table saw, and is it the center blade or one of the main blades has the ability to do this miter within the dado. And I imagine this is something that like you could see in your head, you could understand how it's going to work, but it was not something you could just mock up in your shop to test, right? You had to go get somebody to make this. It was like, what was that process like of, okay, I'm spending the money to get somebody to machine this and make this to the first time you were able to test it? That had to be like a huge monumental moment, right?
It took some work. I was aided again by that period of time where I spent ridiculous hours digging through obscure sections of the internet. Tool making, custom router bits was the particular direction that helped me out, because I wanted a router bit and it didn't exist. And okay, are there custom shops that make weird router bits as a one-off? And turns out, yes, they are. Mm-hmm. And so I found several of those shops. One in particular was not just router bits, carbide cutting tool prototyping shop. So before I'd even conceptualized the idea of a blade, I had exchanged some emails about this weird router bit that I wanted with a contact at this company. So when I got far enough along to describe this blade to him, I sent it to the same contact and he said, okay, $400, we can make this for you.
Oh, wow. Nice.
So it wasn't not as hard as you might think to get something custom made like that. I think it's easier because you got to cough up $400, but if you really want to do it, it is possible.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. So that was your first design. And at this point, were you still working a day job outside of this, or had you gone all in, or what was that transition like to from you still had I assume a day job and not woodworking, right?
Yeah. At this point, I still had a day job in agriculture, still working for Cargill. And I was doing this in my spare time, just trying to manage a hobby that I was really excited about and trying to turn into a side business, a family, an MBA program that I was working my way in, and the job. Time management strategies were important. Being in the moment on whatever I was doing was important. Efficiency, all of those things I have thoughts on and became very important. A lot of the content I was listening to did start to shift from woodworking to these sort of motivational / efficiency people online. There's lots of folks that have lots of things to say about trying to get yourself more productive. I did start to consume more of that content as that time crunch really ramped up.
Yeah. Cause I remember when I first, and I don't know if it was David Picciuto or I was very, at this time, it's very, you know, very similarly, like I was in woodworking and the commercial side, but had started following you and a number of YouTubers and really have gone down the rabbit trail of the maker community. And I do remember when you first came out with the idea video for this invention. And after that, you've had many others, right? And obviously you've had more products since then, but just from the perspective of just a follower who I didn't know much about you other than I followed you on YouTube. And I remember even researching this interview, looking back and realizing, one, how many years I'd been following you and some of the videos, how long it was between that it didn't seem like it from a casual passive viewer. Like I'm sure it was many years from conception to that video to, hey, you've licensed this. And even after that, so what did you launch this product or you got it licensed, you went through a bidding process, I assume. Did that spur you to say, hey, this is really something, like I have all these other ideas? Was that like, or what happened after that to what you've done now? You've had multiple other products, the twin turbo vice, the now with mag switch, and it's kind of like it opened up this whole new world for you, or?
Yeah. Here's how I would describe it. As I was developing and putting money into the miter fold blade, that's what it ended up being called. As I was doing that, there was this constant voice in my head of, it's impossible that this will ever do anything and make any money. Like, that little demon in my head was just a constant pestering nuisance that I had to argue against every step of the way. I have to imagine a lot of other people would feel a similar kind of thing. It is just impossible that something I came up with is ever going to be out there as a product people can buy. And that's the only way this ever actually has an ROI. So what you're doing is silly. It was just constant. And after it did do that, voice doesn't go away. The voice changes, that was a one-time thing, is now the narrative. But that's a much weaker, that's an easier thing to push through. Definitely think it got easier just because that particular cautionary voice in my head was easier to argue against. And that's not all good. That means sometimes ideas that aren't so great get pushed forward. And there have been a few. The great thing about the, YouTube algorithm is that if it's not that great an idea, not that many people see it. If you dig through my channel, there are a few concepts following the miter foil blade that I put out there that really, at the best, needed a lot more refinement. And if you're being less charitable or silly.
So something I'm really curious about, it's a little bit off track. You were coming into the woodworking industry in many ways as an outsider, right? Maybe you felt that way, but also, I imagine the internet can be a pretty harsh place sometimes. And,
sure.
And I know woodworkers can be territorial a little bit. So how did you feel your reception was, not only as a YouTuber, a content creator, learning woodworking, like you mentioned, your table and how it was received, but now creating new product designs that I assume you got a lot of feedback in a variety of format. What was your reception? How did you feel like woodworkers received you?
So as we'll talk about two things, there's the how did they receive you as someone who makes fine furniture, and how did they receive you as an inventor? In general, both very good. I tried on the, as far as fine furniture, I didn't always present myself accurately as someone fairly new to woodworking, just trying to do ambitious things off the go. I think I came across more as, because with editing, you can present yourself a certain way. I think I came across as more experienced than I really was. And due to some of those insecurities, maybe I didn't show as many mistakes as I could have. I showed some, but I remember, I think it was Kyle Toth. It was, gosh, I can't remember who it was. It's another person in the community. The name's escaping me. Sorry. But they said, when I had eventually done here's every woodworking project I'd ever done. And it was like 12. I thought you'd been making furniture a lot longer than this. This was not in a negative way. It's like, wow, you're much newer to this than I really thought you were. And I think a lot of other people felt that way. So I, as a furniture maker, I feel like I was accepted. You know, there's always 1 out of 100 comments that's negative, but you just discard that because there's always somebody saying a mean thing. But I feel like the reception was really pretty good, probably because I wasn't so accurate about how new I was to it. In the tool making space, and when a video goes this crazy, the more viral a video goes, the more negative comments, just even as a percentage, not the absolute number of negative comments, of course, goes up, but even the percentage of negative comments go, because a popular video, it's being shown to a very wide audience beyond your core followers. Mm-hmm. That's effect number one. And those people outside of your core audience are more likely to say nasty things. And then there's also just a factor of people like to shout down a thing that's trending and popular and like to be the one to say, actually. So there was a lot on that miter fold video. There was a lot of negativity on a percent basis. We're still probably talking like only 5 or 6% negative, and the rest positive, but that was more than usual on a percentage basis. And I did notice that and hadn't quite developed the perspective of now when I start to see negative comments, I get excited because that means the algorithm saying, okay, this is an interesting video. We're going to show it out more broadly. And when I start getting those kind of, it's like a combination of ignorance and negativity that I get excited about, because that means the video is doing well and starting to resonate. And so I just skip the even being triggered by it at all and go right to, okay, maybe this video is gonna do something. If I want to feel that again, I got to start posting more videos. I'm so busy with just business management stuff. I haven't been doing as much content lately, but that's another topic. Did that answer the question?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Okay.
Because obviously early on, being in that YouTube maker community and a lot of the projects you were doing, and even this, right, were very probably either hobbyist or home woodworker or the like. And but at some point, obviously, this Dado blade is also commercially available now. It was by a large woodworking company. And you've had several products since then. And at some point, you got linked up with Magswitch.
Right.
How did that come about?
Magswitch, fast forward... We're fast forwarding quite a bit. I'd launched a couple other products that I'd licensed. I had gained confidence through that whole process enough to try it on my own. And I did that with the pencil making and TurboVise. And I was working on some efforts to do plans, to sell plans, because I'd seen other people have a lot of success with that. I'd never really have that myself. I came up with the idea of a switchable magnet that you could make yourself. And I put the plan out there and the video did really well. And the CEO of Magswitch commented, and his comment resonated enough or seemed different enough that I looked him up and found him on LinkedIn and we started a conversation. Magswitch had not had a real champion, an innovative product developer, woodworking enthusiast leader for quite a while, actually since the start of the business. They'd been without that, and there hadn't been any new products in quite a while, and I had some ideas for new products. So we worked up a consulting agreement, kind of a trial period where I would consult for Magswitch, try to bring some new products forward, which we did at the end of 2019. And because that was a success and I enjoyed working for Magswitch and I had other ideas and they were going to give me a lot of latitude as far as what I could develop, I left my job at Cargill and took the job at Magswitch. So still traditional employment, but in the space that I wanted to be in woodworking product development. And so, I started that March of 2020. Interesting time to start a new job.
Very recently, and COVID started. So I remember that video when you came out, and I was not aware just myself of Magswitch before that. When you made that video of the magnet, were you aware of Magswitch, or was it just happenstance, or was it like, I don't remember, actually did it in a Magswitch, or you made your own version of one?
I made my own. I was very aware of Magswitch. I had gotten a Magswitch featherboard very early on in the journey and just thought it was the coolest thing. It was the universal featherboard. I still have it. The original one I got, I think it was a Christmas present that I had asked for. And even before that, I was a tinkerer as a kid. I'd Legos and I'd build my own Rube Goldberg machines in my room. And I'd build alarm systems so if someone opened the door to my room, they'd make noise and stuff. I was always tinkering and building silly stuff. And magnets always featured heavily because I always thought magnets were cool. So a magnet that I could turn on and off, I was just fascinated in. Very aware of Magswitch. It was a build your own version. And so I think that was the state of things at the time that I made the video.
Okay. And for those listening who don't know, Magswitch ultimately is, they make use of magnets that you can twist a knob and it turns them on. Very, very strong magnets. So you can use them to fix to machines, to anything. But then when you turn the knob, it's very easy to disarm the magnets, for lack of a better word, right? Like they uses the polarization of the magnets to basically cancel each other out, I think. Is that right?
Yep. It's when it's turned off, when you perceive it to be turned off, it's actually turned on internally. So all the flux is just happily internally contained and it's not pushed out of the body of the magnet, which means that without any external magnetic field, it doesn't act like a magnet, but it is turned on. All the flux is turned on inside.
And Magswitch as a company has leveraged this and made use of this in many different industries had them.
Right.
And woodworking, it sounds, was one subset of their business that before they brought you back on had fallen away or maybe not had a lot of innovation for a time, sounds like, right?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. We were still getting the tools out there and the same product line was still selling through all of the different dealers. And there had been some people managing that dealer relationship and let's get some specials out and how do we get the marketing and those kind of efforts, but not how do we add to the product line. That hadn't been done in a while just because they couldn't find the right person to do it.
Awesome. And so that, you know, as you alluded to earlier, I said the now years of personal research and just constantly, you know, absorbing content, learning all you can about woodworking. Now you were able to glean on from that library of knowledge of, okay, one, what do woodworkers use and need? What is lacking in that space? Mm-hmm. And what now since then you've help them develop, I assume, a number of products, but I know of at least the most recent one, is it the power feeder attachment?
The power feeder mount. That's not the most recent, but I think our second most recent was the launch of two mount products, one for a power feeder, one for a drill press vise. Okay. So that was an attempt to try to put products out in a space that Magswitch hadn't really occupied as far as cabinet shops. Granted, smaller cabinet shops, but you're a pretty serious woodworking hobbyist if you have a power feeder. That would be way on the semi-pro level of hobbyist if you're going to purchase a power feeder. If you're cutting so many things to need a power feeder on a regular basis, that's a pretty big purchase. I wanted to see if we could do something in that space, and the power feeder mount was the first attempt.
Because outside of that, generally, like in my experience at least, we would have, you know, old German made, you know, very sturdy equipment that if we wanted a power feeder, we're either tapping into the cast iron table or creating some sort of mount or jerry rigging something up in the shop or not having a power feeder at all. So I assume leveraging these magnets, you know, I think a lot of people may be listening that aren't familiar with mags. Well, how is a magnet going to hold a power feeder? These things have to be significant holding power, I assume.
Yeah, Magswitch makes industrial magnets to lift 50-ton plates of steel. Like, you can make them as strong as you want by multiple magnets coupled together by gear assemblies or electronically. You can make them as strong as any need requires. It's just a matter of cost. Can the cost be justified? So strength isn't a problem if you're willing to pay for it. And the person who rang us up a month ago and said, I just bought a Felder table saw. I asked about a power feeder and they told me I had to drill and tap holes in the top. I want a 4-magnet assembly to hold a 1-horsepower power feeder. That individual was willing to spend the money on that mount.
Yeah. And so that's what this latest or one of the latest tools does, allows you to mount a power feeder straight to the surface of your table and easily move it around. You're not even now captive by where you drilled those holes.
Yes, that's true. So there's an advantage just beyond the frustration and annoyance of needing to drill holes in your metal top. You can move it around any place you want it. It's easy to pull it off. If you have sheet goods, that's going to cover the spot where the power feeder needs to be mounted. I think it's a lot better.
Yeah. And then you said the other one, more recent one, was for the drill press?
The drill press vise bait. Yeah. It's a similar kind of problem. You're not drilling and tapping, but you're bolting down a drill press vise in place, or maybe you're using C-clamps or something. And then the underside of the drill press table, there's always a ridge right where the C-clamp wants to land. And for any given operation, you might be repositioning 3 or 4 times. That's not uncommon at all. So it's a lot nicer just to be able to turn magnets off and on to get the drill press vise repositioned.
Yeah. Awesome. And so those are the two most recent ones. And that was, so it sounds like a concerted, like a intentional push towards more manufacturing, production, a commercial customer.
That was a space that felt underserved. In general, that's a direction Magswitch has gone with products. And it felt like a natural and appropriate direction to take woodworking. Not the only direction, but
yeah, one of them. Because before that, you had help to develop some products with Magswitch that were more homeowner, hobby wood shop type baker products, I assume.
Filled holes in the existing line, where a similar kind of market. You're still talking about hobbyist with a cast iron top saw is a more serious hobbyist than probably 9 out of 10 others. That's a heavy, expensive machine that you're making a bigger commitment to that hobby if you've taken it to that. But still in that same top tier hobbyist or semi-pro. There certainly are cabinet shops that have our featherboards that absolutely exists, but that's not the lineage of the demographic.
And so those were featherboards specifically you mentioned, or products that alternatively they're either having to mount to the miter slot or screw to the fence or something like that. And you have a couple versions of that can similarly just magnetize right to the top. Okay.
Yep.
So now that's the things you've been working on at MagSwitch. Talk a little bit more about, you mentioned you're doing an MBA and you left your job at Cargill, you mentioned, and so now you're fully into this new industry and this new role. What is your role as vice president of the maker business at MagSwitch? Like, you know, you're helping develop these products. Is that kind of like there's cycles of, hey, we're working on this new product, or is there a lot of things outside of that you're focusing on all the time?
Within MagSwitch, there is more. Let me back up. The product development pipeline kind of a continuous thing. So there at this time, there are concepts in development that I can't talk about yet, things that'll launch over the course of the next year. There are even looser sort of concepts floating around in my head that haven't even solidified into anything that I've told our engineering team about yet. In order to keep a product line healthy and growing, you need to be coming out with new things, and I intend to make that happen as long as I'm there. And that requires a pipeline of innovation. It's continuously refreshed. That's always going on, depending on where you are in the cycle. If you've got a launch coming up in a month, then that's all consuming. It takes a lot of time to get that messaging right, and your work with marketing and everything there. So I do have someone working as a dealer manager. So talking to all of our various dealers about any promotions that are coming up, their marketing materials, can we get a banner on your website? You know, having all of those discussions. When I joined Meg, I had to do all of that, and I never worked in retail. That was probably the biggest stretch for me, skills, competency, and interest-wise, was the dealer management side of things. So I do have someone. I grew the business enough to say, please get me someone. So I got approval to hire that key dealer manager. So that's helped a lot keep me where really my interest and skills are in that product development to marketing cycle. The other thing happening and recently at MagSwitch is I've been getting involved more in the industrial sides of the business as far as heavy lifting and welding and some of that larger fixturing business. So I'm not sure it has less relevance to my channel. So you'll probably see less of that. But I was at FabTech talking to steel service centers about our lifters a couple of weeks ago, which was awesome. I'm so pumped to got to see that. And there are a lot of really cool industrial applications that I may be getting more into beyond what you describe as a woodworking or the maker business. And so that's good. After 4 years there, it's exciting to see some of those other industrial broader challenges. And there's some things I'm excited about there. So I'm going to spend some time on that problem, even if it's not so aligned with my intention to be in the woodworking industry. Its interests evolve, and there's definitely some stuff there I'm excited about.
Awesome. And outside of that, obviously, you still have your YouTube channel, and mm-hmm. You're putting out content. You mentioned not as much as you'd like to, but I know, like, behind your video recently about the finishing of the 3D printer shelf, right? Yep, and upgrading all to
right.
Is it the Anchor 3D printer?
Yep, the Anchor Make.
And so is that something, I assume there's a certain amount of, you have your basement shop, I know, and I assume there's a lot of work you do there that helps with your product design, but also just as a personal fulfillment, right? You're continuing to make things. Is how much of your product development and kind of ideation and stuff do you feel is either dependent on or helped by those extracurricular making that you do?
I've come to really understand it's important for me to always be making things. If I go a couple weeks without being in the shop making things, I am just less inspired in all aspects. I need to be making things on a regular basis, to be thinking about the process. I find it just cathartic in and of itself. I'm just a person who has to be making things all the time. So carving out the time to get down to the shop and build things is really important for me. So that can take a lot of forms. In the last 2 years, I've added a lot of products that I'm making myself to my personal business, the Inclined product line. The Benchdog tops and Vice Jaws and some accessories for the pencil making tool are all products that I make myself, and some of those sell reasonably well. And that's what I'm working on right now to try to get ready for the holiday season. That definitely counts, because the challenges of making thousands of Benchdog tops, that's really interesting challenge, much different than making one. Every little bit of efficiency counts. I did a video where I made 10 boxes and I talked about how I'd heard it's important to try to make a lot of something. And through this process of making 10 boxes, I'm starting to see that. And that's all that was true, but it's much more intense when you're trying to have like production shop. Making 1,000 of something is no joke. Doing it in your spare time in your basement. That's a very challenging thing to do, but a fun challenge in a lot of ways of how can I get this process as efficient as possible and remove every chance of error and rework, and that stuff will just kill you. So it just cannot exist. The process has to work. And in this current production run I'm in, it's the first time I can really say it's all really worked without any issues. Knock on a particle board.
You know, you have, outside of Mag Switch now, you have still have like your twin turbo vice. You've got these Bench Dogs. You have a lot of products that you mentioned that you are actually still manufacturing yourself outside of just making, you know, things like that, the table behind you. And I know I've seen many of your videos about things in your office, but you are actually in production on products that you are actively selling. Are there other things that you have that you hope to make, you know, as a part of Inclined, as your own products outside of MagSwitch that you still have in your head? Are those things constantly coming up at this point?
They are. I don't anticipate doing a lot more new physical products through Inclined for the foreseeable future. There's a few things there. So when I took the job at MagSwitch, it's a well-compensated full-time job, and an employer, they're being very generous letting me continue with what I'm doing. But there were some conversations about how much new product development are you going to be doing? You know, things like plans, things like sponsorships, new videos, all of that's not really a problem. But there were some very fair restrictions put on product development, not only just because it would take time away. I mean, I'm being hired to run the business. So if you've got a great woodworking idea, you know, we want that to be ours. That's totally fair. I did launch the Pika screws on my own, and I do have an idea. So this is the first time I'm saying this publicly. I do have an idea for how the Pika screws can be cheaper. And I'm trying to see like substantially cheaper with reasonable compromises in what they are. Pika screw being a screw with a slot that's only visible when you press the side, if people aren't familiar. And they're at a price point right now that works for very high-end furniture, for guitar makers who only need one or maybe two to fix a neck to the body of a guitar. There are definitely applications for them. I'm selling them. People find them delightful the way the slot appears. It's doing what I want them to do, but I can't really pitch an architectural firm to try to incorporate them in all of their handrail, right? At $27 a screw, that's a very hard sell. So it would be a pretty cool thing if it really was more broadly applicable to those interior design, architectural, display making. There's quite a few industries. If I could get the price down substantially, I think I'd have a reasonable shot at it. Exciting. So I'm working on that. We'll see if you never hear anything about it, maybe I wasn't able to do it. It's a tricky thing to get the cost down on, but I am working on that. I am thinking about potentially adding some sponsorships, some more, I mentioned plans. I still feel like I haven't really cracked that. I haven't had a plan that's been like a real hit seller. And so So I'd like to try to get there with the plans and up both the quality of the idea and the plans themselves. So that's the thing that I'm working on with the side business. But those will be the more of the direction that I go in the next few years anyway. So don't expect something brand new like the Twin Turbo Vice coming from Inclined in the near future.
Yeah. Awesome. Before we wrap up, there's a couple questions that I like to ask every one of my guests. And I'm really curious. I think you have a very unique perspective from most of my guests. And so the first question is, what do you see in the woodworking industry over the next 5 to 10 years changing?
What do I see in the woodworking industry in the next 5 to 10 years changing?
Aside from more people buying MagSwitch.
More people buying MagSwitch, yeah. That's I certainly would like to see that. Let me just talk. I mean, my mind went initially to digital fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
That's really been the change over the last 10 years. I think there'll be continued innovation in that space. And I think we'll see more. I think those will continue to get to price points that are more affordable. Lasers certainly have come down in cost, and they're easier to use than they used to be. So I would expect continued clever digital products to be an increasingly larger of the equation. Here I'm being naive. I guess I don't know if we will see a whole lot of. I don't know that the pace of change will be quite as much as we've seen over the last 10 years. Over the last 10 years, we've seen a lot of commercial technologies that have been made available to a serious enthusiastic hobbyist. Lasers and CNCs and the shaper I've put in the CNC category. I don't know. I've thought about this. Okay, are there additional industrial processes that could be scaled down and made available to the hobbyist? And maybe like a robot arm CNC would fit into that category. Wendell Castle had a robot arm CNC that he cut his shapes on. So he forced that to happen. So there could be some of that dish. I don't think anyone's now I'm starting to convince myself that a robot arm CNC at $5,000 would be a good thing to do. I actually think it probably would be. I think there may be something that I'm not aware of. I know there are lathe versions of this. But so you might continue to see some of that scaling down of industrial technology to the hobbyist. I would predict not as much as we have seen over the last 10 years. I'm not giving a real precise answer, and I'm rambling a bit, but I think I'm going to stick with that. I'm on the record, and if it's just an explosion of all kinds of crazy new concepts and even more of a wild year, and AI is going to just design all our furniture and spit it out, then people can play this podcast and say I was wrong. But I don't know that it will be as big a change as we've seen.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I agree that what we have seen is a lot of, obviously, technology and CNC equipment being more accessible. And even on the commercial side, obviously they dubbed it industry 4.0 and a lot of automation and stuff like that, but there's still a lot of manual work being done that's required to be done. I think that it's been a little bit of a marketing farce that most manufacturing can be completely automated today. And I think that it can be, but it not in an accessible way that a lot of manufacturers are able to execute well. I do think something that's interesting, though, and I think Shaper's a good example, and even what you're doing at MagSwitch is a good example, is things going the other way of things from more the hobbyist maker community, from a product design and manufacturing technology coming more into the commercial space. So Shaper's one that I followed. I remember when it first came out, and it was very much marketed towards the hobbyists, the makers. And now you see it at these, you know, IWF and AWFS conferences now being marketed towards manufacturers and more commercial applications, which I remember when I first saw it, I was working at a door company. And so we would constantly make these plywood jigs to route our hinge mortises.
Right.
And then we would have, even in the field, and I always thought, man, if I had that shaper, that could be applied easily to just do my hinge mortises, my lock mortises, and things like that on the edge. So I think what you're doing with now at MagSwitch, making products that are now accessible and useful in the woodworking space for commercial applications, not just, you know, home shop or even from a marketing perspective. So I think that's interesting to see maybe the pendulum swinging the other way.
That's really interesting. But what you were saying made me think of a few other things that I think I'd like to mention. I think you're going to see more techniques integrate 3D printers to woodworking. I think there's a lot there. Mm-hmm. Just a few examples that I've done recently. I made a vacuum plate with a 3D printer. So model it in CAD, print it on a 3D printer, vacuum holds a two-piece of wood, use a flush trim bit to cut that form. That's mm-hmm. a really interesting front add to wood. Just using a cheap 3D printer, you don't need a CNC. You could batch out a lot of them much faster than a CNC anyway. Technique that I think I'm the first person to do. I've never seen anyone else do it. Izzy and I were the first ones to put vacuum templates out there as a concept, and 3D printing them, I think, is new. I made custom layout tools. So for this fiddly little situation, I modeled something up and then had a perfect layout tool for exactly what I needed right off of the 3D printer. I think you're going to see more of that technique wise. Mm-hmm. I think that's a ripe area to explore, and one that I'm definitely excited about and have lots of ideas for things that I could show. And you're in industry. I'm not sure how often that do cabinet shops have a 3D printer. And if you need that custom form for a hinge, could you print exactly what you need? It seems like that would be quite useful in a lot of cases to make a custom setup jig or whatever it is for repeatable tasks. Have you seen a lot? You know more about the industrial side than I do.
Yeah. So honestly, I haven't seen a lot of it. However, there are people like, so I was an engineering manager 5-6 years ago at a shop, and I had one of my guys that brought in his 3D printer, and we used it for a number of things. One was on the commercial side, a lot of times you have to do custom moldings. So, you know, and you have to grind a knife, for example. So if the architect or client says, hey, I want this trim profile that you need a custom knife for, generally you have to grind a knife, make some runs of that, and then submit that piece of wood now for approval that might get changed. And so what we did is I actually just extruded and 3D printed that exact profile before we cut a knife, primed it, made it look like a piece of trim to get approved before we even made the knife. And then something else you can do, generally the shops will cut on a CNC, like a template out of Plexi or something that they use as a guide to grind the knives, but you could just as easily 3D print. We also did a couple of things, like we would have really custom solid model reception desks that we would model at scale for approval and print that. But that's like an anomaly, but not enough. I don't think very many shops are making use of 3D printers. Now, I do know of two companies that have been talking about one. Actually, I just had a podcast episode recently with Dominic Rubino, and he said he is a client that one of his business goals is to have the first fully 3D printed kitchen. And I know you mentioned robotic arms. I know of another millwork business owner that is actively developing and building his own like Fanuc arm controller. I don't know if it's Fanuc brand, but 3D full scale, large scale 3D printer to be able to make interior structures. Generally, we make like reception desks and banquettes out of plywood structures cut on a CNC and put together. But somebody has to fabricate those. So he's thinking, hey, I can make a 3D printer that you can get fire resistant plastic, basically, that you can print at a high melt point. And if he can have a robot arm. So I was thinking, as you were mentioning robot arm, okay, if robot arms become more accessible, maybe they could be mounted to a MagSwitch base to put wherever you need as a co-working robot or something like that.
That's so actually one of the products in the automation lineup is a base for our cobot. Oh, really? So yeah. We have end effectors, a whole different array of different end effectors to grab and pick up things at the end of the robot arm, but we also have a base to mount them. Yep. So
that's interesting.
That is out there.
Destin's Ready to Latest Smarter Every Day video was about robot arms that do metal forming, and they use different end effectors. So that's a callback to a term I recently learned that now I know what it means.
Yep. I did see Destin's video, and I did notice that he seemed to know the lingo quite well. Yep.
Yeah.
So,
I asked you what do you see changing, but I always like to ask on the flip side, what do you see staying the same in the industry over the next 5 to 10 years?
This is much more targeted towards the hobbyist semi-pro. I don't see the interest in high-end traditional hand tools waning at all. I think that is a long-term trend, that a reversal of what had happened in the 70s and 80s back to wanting to have a motor on everything. I don't think the enthusiasm level for high-end hand planes are chisels, saws. I don't think any of that is going away. I would be very surprised if in 10 years, that's not still something that people want to have. I think they're just a lot of fun to use. Having a proficiency in traditional hand tools adds a lot to a work process. Even throughout the process of making thousands of something, the bench dog tops, having those competencies to some degree has helped me a lot. So that I don't think is going anywhere.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think similarly, as that pendulum has swung back towards hand tools and kind of handmade stuff, and it's actually still very applicable and adds a lot of value. I even see now, I follow a lot of like framers and carpenters who will pull out a hand plane on mm-hmm. the job site a lot now, more than you would have seen in the past.
Right.
Awesome. I really appreciate you taking time out to interview. You've been somebody I've looked up to and followed for a long time. And I know that there's going to be people that are going to get a lot of value and enjoy hearing this interview. If people want to find out more about you or MagSwitch, what is the best way for them to reach out and find out more?
Probably my YouTube channel, Andrew Klein, K-L-E-I-N. I've got videos on there about my personal business and about MagSwitch. If you scroll through the videos and find MagSwitch heavily featured on the title and thumbnail, then it's probably about MagSwitch, and all the links you need will be there. So that's the quickest and easiest way to send people. I will look at every comment. I don't respond to everyone, but if you want to get in touch, you'll find links to my website and everything you need from there.
Awesome. We'll link to that in our show notes so people can get to there quickly. Thank you again. I appreciate so much, and look forward to seeing what you do in the future.
Hey, I really appreciate you having me on. I hope this isn't our last discussion. I think there's quite a bit more that I have to learn about the commercial side of the business. So this has been really exciting, and I appreciated having the conversation very much. So thank you.
Definitely. Love to have you on again.
Great.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Do you want to stay up to date about industry insights, new content, and our community of millworkers? Go to DuckworksMW.com to sign up for our newsletter. I'll see you in the next episode of Verify in Field.